This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.
A woman may read a Game of Thrones.
A woman may start a podcast.
Two women may host Podcasters Landing, the show devoted to the entire A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Two women may cover three chapters each week, followed by history and friendship lessons.
A listener may sit and tune in.
A woman may use adult language.
A woman may reveal spoilers.
A listener may support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Sophia Mayer Studios, all under case.
A woman welcomes a listener to Podcaster's Landing. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Nat.
And today we're covering A Game of Thrones, Jon, Eddard, and Arya.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very, very difficult chapter to read.
Yes, very hard to read. But first we have Jon throwing a little hiss fit.
Yes, yes, he is. He hasn't been very graceful in this chapter at all.
No, not very ungracious at all. And of course, Ned gets betrayed and arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And Arya has to use all of her wits about her to escape from the Red Keep.
Yes. Poor little thing.
Yes. Poor little thing. But first, we have Jon. Like, honestly, for, like, you kind of imagine, like, the food at the Night's Watch being, like, gruel and really yucky, but Jon was breaking his fast on apple cakes and blood sausage, which I'm like, that's not all half bad for the freezing Night's Watch.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's something to do with, you know, it's, like, workers' food. In Brazil, you have a lot of rice and beans, which fills you up, and then you can do more work. So I guess it's that, and it looks really... You know, blood sausage, I'm not going to say that I like that. But, you know, it is decent so far, anyway. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's because they have so little people to feed that they are able to stretch out more.
This is true. Although, I'm not really that tempted or find sausage appealing because I have become pescatarian, which I feel has contributed to my overall health and well-being and mood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a good start to the year.
Indeed. But yeah, just, you know, them like apple cakes and sausage, not too bad. And begins with Sam, has plopped himself down on the bench. I've been summoned to the Sept. I'm to be made a brother with the rest of you. Can you believe it?
And Jon's like, no, really?
Yeah.
Like he didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, truly, I'm to assist Maester Aemon with the library and the birds. He needs someone who can read and write letters. You'll do well at that, Jon, said Jon, smiling. So, basically they all go to, like, the little sept, which Jon says reminds him, like, of the little sept that Ned, like, built for Catelyn. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that smells a lot like incense.
Yeah, again, very Catholic.
Very Catholic,
in its imagery.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I remember going to a few churches, back when I was little, and there were some churches who used incense, and it was the most disgusting smell. It just, like, fills up my nose, and I can't even, like, remember it now. It's like, it's giving me a headache just thinking about it. But yeah, that is a very Catholic thing to do with the incense.
Yeah, so because if I hadn't already done it in an earlier chapter, I would have done that as my history lesson. But, you know, that was already taken with our first Catelyn chapter. But
yeah,
anyway. They're all at the Sept, and what he made the comment that the Sept was, Septon was finally sober for once.
I know. I mean, I guess it's cold up there. You need something to keep you warm, so might as well drink.
Yeah, and they don't have my cupcakes, so.
Exactly. Yeah.
They gotta resort to booze.
100%. 100%. Although drinking, when I'm drunk, I get colder.
Really?
It was weird. Yeah.
Again, that just makes me more further appreciate. I had a glass of Persian tea with lemon.
Nice,
so good.
Oh, it's really nice. It's really nice.
Yeah, one of the perks of having a Persian husband.
I know. I miss having Persian tea and Persian food and. Anyway.
And so, Mans, for the Night's Watch, lives his life for the realm, not for a king, not a lord, not for the honor of this house or that house, neither for gold, nor glory, nor a woman's love, but for the realm and all the people in it. A man of the Night's Watch takes no wife, fathers no sons. Our wife is duty, our mistress is honor, and you are the only sons we shall ever know. Which, again, we just don't have that anymore, like a sort of like monistic, but soldier like military militant order that that quote unquote has a higher cause than any specific allegiance to any specific like faction or nation or whatever.
That doesn't exist anymore. I guess the only thing closest nowadays that I can think of is being a priest.
Just the what was it called? A paladin in like a lot of those fantasy games where like this sort of figure exists. I don't know why. I just started thinking of the US's failed attempts to like create a military in Afghanistan and the and the way everything crumbled so quickly and how swiftly the Taliban took over and they should have taken a page out of the Night's Watch books because, you know, the sort of selfless duty for, like, the whole of Afghanistan. But, you know, the Afghan state is so fragile that a lot of people, like, don't have any loyalty except to their tribe and, like, to, like, religion. Like, there isn't this collective ethos of Afghanistan is this, like, as a modern nation state is worth protecting and saving. And defending.
They don't care. They don't care about anything else, I guess. It's just, you know what, the US should butt out of people's of other countries' issues.
Yes, well, again, America has superseded Britain in terms of screwing over with colonial crap. Just made me think, one of my coworkers was saying, like, the Taliban is having staffing issues. And it's like, that's an article that came up in her newsfeed. Yeah, because literally, like, some sort of the really tech-savvy jobs, they can't fill them because all of those, like, super techies have gone into exile now because they know they won't be...
Well, yeah,
you know,
of course.
Ideologically, they're so extreme that they can't even get qualified people to fill the positions of their regime.
Yeah, absolutely. And so they should. So they should just fuck off and leave them.
Yeah. Anyway, I digress.
But anyway, what I find it interesting, so, you know, Mormon is saying, you know, you can take your vows here in the Sept, or is there anyone else who keep to the old gods? And then John says, yeah, I do. He says, I expect you want to say your words before a heart tree as your uncle did. And John, something that I found curious is that, you know, John says, yes, my lord. And then it says here, the gods of the Sept had nothing to do with him. The blood of the first men flowed in the veins of the Starks. So he's having a bit of trouble, I guess, sort of like letting go of his house. And because, you know, Lord Mormon says, you know, you have no house, you serve the realm. And he's still a bit stuck in the Starks. And then if you see in comparison, you know, later in a bit in the chapter, Sam is just very ready to give up, you know, his house, because he wants to go to God's woods with John, who he considers his brother now.
I found it interesting, like, I sort of interpret John's, like, insistence of, yes, definitely, like, the gods would, I want to go there, not the Sept, because I think there is this sort of association with the Seven and Catelyn Stark, who was, you know, because it's not like, you know, Sansa or Arya, where they're legit, like, half and half, where, like, where they kind of, you know, for their own reasons, lean one way or the other, so I think... John perceives, like, you know, the Seven as, you know, intrinsically linked to Catelyn, which is not happy memories and not very nice triggers. So
no, and that's fine. That's fine for him to like keep to the old gods, but it's the fact that it says, you know, the blood of the first men flowed in the veins of the Starks, and he's like considering himself as the Starks. That I just find it a bit curious because he does battle a lot up leading up to this point. He does battle a lot of what he should do, if he should go back or if he should not go back. You know, he's struggling a lot with where to find home. And then I thought in his last chapter, we did sort of, you know, he did kind of resign to that, to being there, that is his home. But I guess we will see as well, I guess in his next chapter, that he will struggle with that when he learns about, you know, the Rob's calling the banders and, but yeah.
Yeah, I also paid note to, like, you know, Sam so willing to try, you know, a different religion, especially in just in this context of, you know, a sort of medieval society where religion is absolutely everything. Like, you know, you know, we can't always fully appreciate just how radical it is to, you know, completely, because that's literally their science, how they view the world. And so to completely reshape your worldview about the cosmos and everything is a big deal, which is why people are so resistant to Melisandre and her new stuff she's bringing.
Yes, for sure. For sure.
Yeah, but Sam is just like, you know, Sam is all about, like, I like the North. I like John. Like, I like all this stuff the Starks are bringing. I want to be part of that.
Yeah, I think that John was the first and only person who has shown him kindness for a very long time. Well, I guess apart from his mum, but, you know, someone that is...
Someone, you know, a fellow male who validates his, you know, his skill, his strengths and his weaknesses.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you know, he considers him family now, which is good. So it's very nice.
Yep. And so Mormont's like, yep, you guys will all, you know, take your vows. And then so basically they're reading out like who's going to go to like which section of, you know, of the Night's Watch. And of course, we've got Sam being a steward. Piper is a ranger and everyone's happy. And then finally, it's like John to the stewards. And John is like, da fuck.
He is furious, just seething. And he was going to object. But then he saw Sir Alistair Thorne.
And it's just like, shit, you know? I cannot give him a reaction.
Well, no, he knew that, you know, because Alistair Thorne has sort of like a glint in his eye. And he knew that he might have had like a finger on that. That's what he thought anyway at that instant.
Yeah, or at least that John would, he knew John would be immature enough to misinterpret this. So I didn't like John in this chapter because, again, he went through all of that with Maester Aemon to show that, you know, Sam has skills that are useful. So he's gone through all of that explaining, you know, breaking that sort of rigidity of this society and those traditional like masculine roles, but when it comes to him doing it, it's not even he's not phrasing it as like, yes, that's good for Sam, that's what Sam's good at, I'm just not good at those things, I'm good with a sword. But he frames it as like, am I supposed to be like a girl? So like he invests all this effort in Sam and like validating Sam, but still he thinks less of Sam deep down.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it says here, you know, when everyone else left, you know, the rangers and the builders, they left. All that was left was Sam, Therion, who was a singer. And then the way that he describes it is like a fat boy, a singer, and him. So he just, like, he perceives them really not well, and it's quite insulting to his friend, to be honest.
And I'm a better swordsman and better rider than any of you, John Blaze Bass. It's not fair. And Darren's just like, fair, he sneered. The girl was waiting for me, naked as the day she was born. She pulled me through the window and you talk to me of fair?
Yeah, because I guess he was accused of raping a girl when it was actually consensual.
Yeah, so you know, this fictional, but, you know, I'm sure there were many scenarios like this in, like, medieval and, you know, early modern societies mm-hmm. where a woman basically, you know, I'm sure there was situations where a woman threw a man under the bus because socially she mm-hmm. felt she had no other choice.
Oh, yeah. 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 You know, it would take away her worth, basically, because mm-hmm. she wasn't a virgin, because she wasn't pure.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes. You know, what I find it really nice of Sam, even though John has been such a dick to him, is that in this next bit, he, you know, still took the time to make John see that it's actually an advantage to be steward, because the Lord Commander requested John personally to be his steward. And, you know, Sam is explaining to him that, you know, before his brother was born, he used to go with his father and do things with his father to learn
how to be the Lord.
Yeah, exactly. So Sam's thinking that Mormont is actually grooming John to be the next commander.
Yes, and it's, yeah, and that's very sweet of Sam, because Sam's like, look, let me break this down for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, as John mentions, he never had that experience because, you know, Ned always did that sort of things with Rob. He didn't do mm-hmm. it with John in any way.
Yeah.
Which I wonder if that was really the wisest thing. I think Ned necessarily, if Catelyn wasn't such a bitch, I don't think Ned would have minded like John, like learning and doing those things. But I think he purely didn't do it to, like, quote unquote, show respect to Catelyn, to be like, I'm not treating, you know, I'm mm-hmm. not treating John as my heir. Our son is definitely the heir. No questions asked.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because they are the same age, right?
Yeah. If anything, Catelyn's always, like, paranoid if John is a little older.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah, no, absolutely. I completely agree. John, if he was legitimate, would have gone as well. It, just in case, I think he would be sort of like, you know, so you can squire for your brother or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, then John realizes, and it says here, and suddenly John Snow was ashamed. Craven or not, Samuel Tarly had found the courage to accept his fate like a man. He'd heard it said the bastards grow up faster than other children. On the wall, you grow up or you die.
Yeah, I could really relate to that expression, you grow up or you die, because that I've had to say that to people in terms of explaining my experience when I would study abroad in the Middle East, because mm-hmm. Of course I had a good time and even went to the occasional like party and whatever at the, you know, at the embassy where no one else is drinking except mm-hmm. there. But the idea that, you know, you're not, you know, going crazy in Paris or Madrid or Rome in a Western society mm-hmm. that you're kind of used to, like, to study in those type of countries and to live there, especially as a woman who obviously looks foreign. That's the period where I went from an adult lesson to adult, because literally, as John says, you either grow up or you die.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, if I tried to be an immature little shit, again, I would have died. Like, something would have, like, I would have gotten beat up, raped, something mm-hmm. If I didn't have my wits about me.
Yeah, it's about respecting the place that you're in and about conducting yourself accordingly. And yeah, and Sean was a little shit, to be honest. And just being really rude to his friend. I know that he, like, was expecting it to be a ranger, but
he just
needs to accept it. What is he gonna do?
Yeah, it's and a part of it, you know, if we want to be more charitable, it's more about, like, I wanted to be a ranger so I could immediately go look for my uncle, you know, mm-hmm. and things like that. But yeah, he's being a little shit.
Yeah.
And so then that finally, after John finally sees, you know, the actual dynamic of this turn of events, you know, they all get together and they go out into the haunted forest, because, you know, they don't necessarily, you know, the Night's Watch doesn't need its own godwoods like Winterfell and mm-hmm. and other things below the wall, because, you know, the haunted forest is right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And he goes and takes Ghost with him. So Ghost mm-hmm. can go and hunt, I guess, you know, might be getting a bit bored mm-hmm. on that side. So, you know, at least he gets to hunt. On the other side of the river. The river? Well, on the other side of the wall.
And I don't know, for whatever reason, I just honed in on the fact that, you know, it's, you know, usually there's only one, like, big weirwood, like, per godswood, mm-hmm. but here there are nine.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, maybe it's just my current little fix on numerology, but I'm like, what is the significance of the number nine? Like, why is it nine trees?
I don't know.
I didn't do any great research. All I know is that, like, when you tally up, like, my birthday and everything, like, do the whole thing, numerological thing, I know, like, my, like, sort of number for my personality is a nine.
Okay.
And, yeah, honestly, for whatever reason, I thought of, like, the nine Nazgul in Lord of the Rings.
I don't know. I honestly don't know Lord of the Rings much.
The ring wraiths, the black hooded figures that chase Frodo.
Oh, okay. Okay.
There are nine of them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe it's a magical number, and mm-hmm. that's why it's there's nine. But yeah, he's never seen so many together.
Mm-hmm. And Sam is just like, they're watching us, he whispered, the old gods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so Sam's really into, you know, the sort of awestruck, to, you know, into the stoic power of the weird trees.
Yeah, yeah, it must be really powerful. They are pretty creepy and scary.
Yeah, and who knows how old they are. All I remember is, you know, yew trees are some of the oldest living organisms on mm-hmm. Earth. Like, you know, there are some yew trees that are thousands of years old, which is why mm-hmm. Voldemort's wand comes from a yew tree, because he doesn't want to die.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, but anyway, so they kneel down and they take their vows.
Yes, which, night gathers, and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death. I shall take no wife, hold no lands, father no children. I shall wear no crowns and win no glory. I shall live and die at my post. I am the sword of the darkness. I am the watcher on the walls. I am the fire that burns against the cold, the light that brings the dawn, the horn that wakes the sleepers, the shield that guards the realms of men. I pledge my life and honor to the night's watch, and for this night and all the nights to come.
Mm-hmm. It's like, you knelt as boys, rise now as men of the Night's Watch. You know, it's just interesting, these sort of coming of age ceremonies, like, in various cultures, like, whether mm-hmm. it's, like, you know, like, the Mexican quinceañera, I don't speak Spanish, but, or, like, you know, the Anglo version, the Sweet 16, you know, in American mm-hmm. culture, and, you know, bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs and the Jewish culture, just, you yeah. know, there's, it's just so interesting because, you know, when you look at, you know, look at humans, like, neurologically, and lots of studies have been shown that you don't really, your brain doesn't really stop growing and developing until you're, like, 25, and people are so on different levels of maturity, and yet, you know, all these cultures have these ceremonies where it's like, yep, you're a man now.
Yeah, yeah, it's a bit scary. Yeah, it's a bit scary that to put that much responsibility in a kid. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think the quinceañeras and sweet 16s, they're more like a party, not very much like you're, you know,
at least the sweet 16 version.
Yeah, no, yeah, not at all.
Yeah,
that, like, one is it just reminds me of the MTV show where there were horribly spoiled people.
Oh, yeah. And so everyone's like, oh, happy, is like, yay. And then Ghost comes back and he's got something in his mouth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's a black gloved severed hand.
That's nice. I don't think it says black glove, is it?
Does it?
Oh, something black. It just says something black. And yeah. They just say, gods be good, that's a hand. Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. And then, so very happy, uplifting chapter, except for the very end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get Ned Stark.
Yeah. Oh, Christ. This is so painful for me to read. So painful. Because at the end of the day... Okay, we'll get there. We'll discuss it. But yeah, it's painful.
So they're all packed, and they're having breakfast. And Arya's like, can I have one more lesson? I'm all packed. And Sirio says, we have time before we take the ship. And Ned is like, yes, you can. Which a good thing he does say yes, because where would she have been otherwise?
Yeah. It's really worrying to think. I have no words, but yeah.
Yes, and Sansa looks up from her food. If she can have a dancing lesson, why won't you let me say farewell to Prince Joffrey? Which, this got me.
Those are two different things, you fucking idiot. But okay.
Those are two different things, and, you know, in many ways, Sansa is a lot like Ned in terms of his idealism. But why is there this disconnect with Ned and Sansa? Why are there such, you know, weaknesses in their relationship that clearly aren't there with Arya or any of his other children?
Because he's not open with Sansa as he is with Arya. You know, we spoke about how he had that talk with Arya and how it would have been really beneficial for him to have had that talk with Sansa. It would have also been beneficial for her mom to have said something before they went. That is like, you need to be careful. Things are not as they seem, you know, down south. And if Ned said to her, you know, had the same talk that he had with Arya, that she needs to be nice to her sister because there are enemies around, she would have been way more alert, way more sympathetic to her dad and would have had a better
connection. I guess it's question, what is the virtue? Like, it's like not wanting to rob your child of their innocence, which... Mm-hmm. They've already seen that Arya is not sort of innocent in that way, so they don't mind talking about that sort of thing. At least Ned doesn't, but he doesn't want to break Sansa's little bubble. And it's like, well, what's the alternative? This shit.
Yeah, you're making it worse at the end of the day because she doesn't understand why you're acting that way. You don't understand why you need to send her away. Just be honest and say, you know, I think the time to protect them is kind of gone. And it's time to be like, look, shit's going to go down when Robert dies.
Or at least in terms of her, like, sort of telling, you know, breaking off the engagement with Joffrey, because that's what she seems to be most upset about. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think he should have, like, told her the truth and, like, maybe not all everything, but tell her the truth that, look, honey, you know, Joffrey isn't a real king. You deserve to be a real princess. Like, he could have framed it in terms that she understood. Like, you deserve to be, like, a real queen, and Joffrey is this bastard. Like, you know, that shouldn't be a thing. Like, and maybe...
I don't know. Knowing her, she would have run straight to them, to the queen.
Well, it depends. Yeah, it depends on would she accept that as the truth, which quite... Or is she so caught up in her... delusion at this point, which I tend to be a little more charitable that if her dad were to I think she knows her dad well enough that he wouldn't throw something out that like that crazy unless it was true.
But I think she's so far gone at this point that she wouldn't, you know, she even though it is the truth, she wouldn't pay attention to it. She would just be like, oh, everything's so unfair and whatever. Mm-hmm. I think they should have caught it early on when she was just like romanticizing everything about going to the south and being in the king's court and whatever.
But again, if killing Lady wasn't enough to break the delusion, like what can, like only killing her father is the thing
that breaks. I mean, early enough, like before she left, you know, and I think coming from her mom, who's, I think they were quite close, coming from her mom would have been better.
Yeah, so Sansa screams it's not fair, pushed back from the table, knocked over her chair, and ran weeping from the Solar. And let her go. I will try to make her understand when we are safely back in Winterfell. Too late for that, Ned. And we get Grandmaester Pycelle finally comes in. It's like King Robert is gone. The gods have given him rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Ned is, of course, just incredibly sad. It was his really good friend. His best friend, I guess. He says it was strange how empty he felt He had been expecting the visit, and yet with those words, something died within him. I think maybe just not only because of the loss of his friend, but I think it's the weight of the thing that he has to do
mm-hmm.
that is giving him that mm-hmm. weariness and sadness.
Yeah. And so he asks, you know, for the small council to, like, come to him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, who is it? It's Barristan Selmy, Littlefinger, and Varys there. Yes, Varys mm-hmm, is also yeah. there. And I just honed in on Varys entered in a wash of lavender, pink from his bath, his plump face scrubbed and freshly powdered, his soft slippers all but soundless. Like what is George R. R. Martin trying to say about Barris and his appearance? And like,
I guess it's just like linking it to being feminine.
Yeah, linking it to being feminine, but then also, you
and
know.
And then untrustworthy because of what is to come, mm-hmm. of what well, Cersei does. And I think it's linking that together.
I guess it's the question of, is, you know, whether whatever, put aside what George R. R. Martin quote-unquote intended, it's just the idea of, you know, Varys is very feminized, you know, but yet he's very dangerous because he's the master of whisperers. But at the same time, you know, he doesn't have the respect of certain people because, again, poison is the woman's weapon, is the craven's weapons. So is it this wider, is it, you know, generally, whether it's the readers or the people in the book, is it about, you know, beating back against certain masculine's, you know, ideals and sensibilities or feeding into them?
No, it's Ned's point of view here.
Mm-hmm.
So Ned will think of him as effeminate mm-hmm. and untrustworthy. Mm-hmm. So it's not like George R. R. Martin is being like, oh, he's being disguised as this effeminate person, but he is quite dangerous. It's not that. Mm-hmm. It's literally linking,
mm-hmm.
you know, Varys' appearance being effeminate mm-hmm. with being untrustworthy mm-hmm. because of the things that will happen in this chapter still. Mm-hmm. So with Cersei. So I don't think it's about showing how dangerous Varys is. It's mm-hmm. about showing Ned's point of view of what Varys is.
mm-hmm. Right, of course. And Lord Varys drops the bomb that Renly has left. Smart guy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, before that, you know, Littlefinger comes in and then says, you know, that little task you set me is accomplished, Lord Eddard. You know, which is, if to cast back to our previous episode and to the previous Ned chapter, he asks Littlefinger to gather the City Watch.
Yeah, bribe them to make sure they do what they say.
Yeah, to do what Ned says. So mm-hmm. Littlefinger saying that has been done. And then Varys enters and, you know, lets him know that Renly has left the city because Ned was waiting for Renly to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And Ned is surprised. It's like, why are you surprised? You know, Renly clearly knew that shit was going to hit the fan as mm-hmm. soon as Robert died. And I think that by Ned refusing like his help
mm-hmm.
And his counsel, I think he felt that he didn't have an ally.
Or you know, Ned could have done a counter offer of, okay, we're not going to do that, but maybe we can do this. And then, like, Renly didn't verbally agree to, like, stay or, like, do anything on Ned's behalf. So how can Ned expect that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if, like you said, if Ned had refused and said, I don't feel comfortable doing that, but I do feel comfortable doing this, which is what he was going to do. You know, if he had just disclosed that to Renly, maybe Renly would have stayed,
Because literally it was about, you know, what Ned was wanting to do, because Joffrey, like, quote-unquote, forced the issue, but basically was going to do what Renly suggested in terms of confiding the queen and her children to their apartments.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, yeah, there is no reason for him not to go to Renly with that sort of counteroffer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And, because it's like, you know, the need to just, Deceit was a bitter taste in his house, but Nen knew he must tread softly here. He must keep his counsel and play the game until he was firmly established as regent. There would be time enough to deal with the succession when Arya and Sansa were safely back in Winterfell and Lord Stannis had returned. So again, all the things we discussed, you know, last week in terms of Ned's strategy, all of it sounds intelligent, but it's like, why did you have to wait until Robert died?
Exactly. Exactly. Could have disclosed it to someone, not Littlefinger.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And of all people, not Littlefinger, or like, I don't know if he so much believes it himself, but like, he seems pretty, it doesn't seem like he's deluded in the sense of thinking that Robert might not die. Like, he seemed to understand pretty well that Robert was dying, so.
Yeah, I think it was sort of preparing for the worst, but hoping the best.
But, it's not. It's hoping for the best and not preparing for the worst.
Yeah. Well, no, he was preparing. I guess he was preparing. Because he clearly had a plan that he didn't disclose it to Renly, which would have been great. But you know, he's keeping his cards close to his chest. But he didn't want to say anything because it says here he trusted neither Pycelle nor Varys, which I think is a bit ridiculous because Varys did come to
him, or Renly,
and. But, you know, Varys did come to him earlier on in the book and was like, I didn't trust you before, but I trust you now. And, you know, just offered that helping hand to him. And I think that if he did tell Varys everything that was going on, Varys would have truly advised him what would happen. And I don't think Varys would have betrayed him as Littlefinger did.
Yeah, it's your goat. You're putting your faith in the guy who fought for your wife's hand, which your brother pummeled him.
Yeah, and he thinks
thinking there's no grudge, and Catelyn hasn't had any contact with him since.
Yeah, yeah, he knows the whole story. It's like we discussed this way before as well.
Yeah,
that you know she didn't even go and see him because her dad forbade her. Yeah, and then he got sent away. So how is that not a grudge?
Yeah, and she refused to like even read the letter that Littlefinger sent. So
yeah,
I guess it's human nature. Like, you know, we want comfort, we want familiarity, we want the devil we know, not the devil we don't know.
Yeah,
you know, in terms of, you know, these types of things.
Again, yeah, and if his stupid wife trusts him, then, you know, of course he's going to trust him. Yeah. Not that she's stupid or anything.
And she's like, he's asking, I would ask this council to confirm me as Lord Protector, but before, you know, they can get really that far.
He gives Barristan Selmy the letter. To see that it, you know, the seal wasn't broken, and then read Robert's words, and then he asked the council to certify him as the protector of the realm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, before they could vote on it,
Rhoar Stewart comes in, his Grace Joffrey of the House Baratheon Lannister, first of his name of the Andals and the Rhoynar and the First Men, Lord of Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm. You know, he's summoning them to the throne room for the small council to pledge fealty.
Yeah, and to plan his little
coronation.
But what I find it interesting is that in his title he has both Houses Baratheon and Lannister. I find that very curious to have both titles, because he would have just been the House Baratheon. So it shows that his wife, well, Cersei, basically just refused to give up her house name and passes on that importance to her children as well.
Joffrey could have hyphenated it, Baratheon Lannister.
It's quite a ominous like scenery, isn't it, when he enters the throne room and he sees that, you know, you have all the king's guards.
Guard, this little shit on this huge ass iron throne. Yeah. Cersei is all decked out in sea green silk with a ring with an emerald the size of a pigeon's egg, and on her head a matching tiara.
Yeah, it doesn't seem very mournful. And you know, behind the throne there was 20 Lannister guardsmen waiting with long swords hanging from their belts, and also the king's guards forming sort of a half moon around the king. And, you know, Ned is so sure that Littlefinger has done what he asked, because it says here, but Littlefinger had kept his promise. All along the walls in front of Robert's tapestries, with their scenes of hunt and battle, the gold-cloaked ranks of the city watch stood stiffly to attention, each man's hand clasped around the haft of an 8-foot-long spear tipped in black iron. They outnumber the Lannisters 5-1. And he's so sure, isn't he?
Yes.
It's just, bless him, his naivety is just...
Yeah.
It's just out of this world.
It's, I'm just wondering if he had gone to Varys instead and kind of asked for the same thing, whether, first of all, if Varys could come up with the money to accomplish such a thing, or would advise him to do something else?
No, he would advise him to do something else, but, I don't think he would have helped, because Varys serves the realm and he wouldn't want a war to break out, I don't think.
Yeah, I guess it would depend on Varys's like estimation of Ned and whether this could be done bloodlessly and seamlessly, which again, we'll never know because there are too many factors.
Yeah. And you know, Joffrey is saying, you know, I want you to make arrangements for my coronation, and I want to be crowned within a fortnight. And, you know, Ned gives Varys the letter that Robert asked him to write to show it to Cersei. Mm-hmm. And Cersei just full on rips the letter in front of him and says, do you think this will protect you?
Which is, I guess it's just interesting in the sense of not even trying to do this facade of quote-unquote due process.
Oh yeah, no.
If you will,
they don't give a shit. You know, she doesn't give a shit anymore. Like, her husband is dead. Her son now sits on the throne, and it doesn't matter. Like, who's gonna arrest her? No one.
Yeah, it's just interesting that with Cersei, obviously, you know, this wasn't enough to save Ned in any capacity, but I think this is the point where, you know, Cersei is like, oh my god, this bastard is dead, I'm so happy, and I finally get to rule and do whatever I want, but ultimately that ends up being her, you know, downfall, because she isn't willing to, like, compromise with the Tyrells and, like, things like that, because she's been so, like, repressed, you know, when Robert was alive, that when he's gone anymore and she can be like the queen mother or whatever, like, she just goes completely crazy, like my Catholic roommate in freshman year.
What happened to your Catholic roommate in freshman year?
Went completely crazy with partying and stuff, because again, she was just seemed to be so repressed, and, like, you know, her clearly had a, you know, her family had a tight leash on her, and, you know, and a lot of kids were like that. And I'm just like, I like to party, but my parents, like, didn't, like, or at least I did not have the desire to go completely batshit crazy.
Yeah. Well, you know, so Barristan said, you know, those were the king's words. He's appalled, of course. And she says, we have a new king now. And, you know, what frustrates me the most is that she gave Ned a way out. Okay, she says to him, bend the knee, my lord, bend the knee and swear fealty to my son, and we shall allow you to step down his hand and live out your days in the grey waste you call home. And to be honest, I do think they would have let him go back, and if they even tried to attack, Ned would have been an advantage in the north, because he would have a lot of people around him, because he didn't have any. He had, I think, 5 of his house in there. And he would also have, you know, the grudge of the north, because they fucking hate the south. So if they ever came to attack him up north, he would have had the protection and he could have won. Honestly. And so she gave him the choice and he didn't take it. And it's so frustrating.
I do not think that well of Cersei. I think, you know, I think she's just saying this in the courtroom, like, in front of everyone to, like, quote-unquote give him an out. But they would have secretly, like, tried to assassinate Ned because they Ned, they would never be at peace with Ned knowing the truth. And Ned being the personality type that he is, even if he's smart enough to, quote-unquote, keep his head down until he's back at Winterfell, they would never feel safe that someone like Ned knows the truth and then, like, secretly, like, you know, texting Stannis and just being, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Behind their backs. So, yeah, I'm not saying it still would have been smart for Ned to accept in this moment just as a way to buy him time so he can escape.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but mm-hmm. Yeah, but I don't think that she legitimately would have just let him go, or at least would have had something else up her sleeve for him, just more discreet.
Yeah. Yeah, you are right. You are right.
Anyway, so Ned is just like, you know, arrest the queen, take her and her children.
It is just so funny. It's just so funny that, you know, Joffrey, because when Ned says, you know, Joffrey is not the true heir, Stannis is, and he's like, liar! Kill them all! He sounds exactly like the Mad King.
Like, does Joffrey know or suspect anything? No. Or is he's just so far above, like, he's so, like, wrapped up in his own little sadistic, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Bubble.
Of course, he's king now, so anyone who, I guess, will threaten that, he's mm-hmm. just like, you're a liar!
Well, just the interesting notion of, if he doesn't know, the fact that he says, like, how dare you, like, I am the firstborn son, of course I am. Like, not even being remotely curious of why Ned would say such a thing.
Yeah, no, he's not. He's just calling him a liar. He's just, you know, and Marcella's like, what does he mean?
What does he mean? Isn't Joff the king now? And yeah. So, of course, they kill all of Ned's men, and mm-hmm. no city watch comes to the rescue, no cavalry comes, and Littlefinger slid Ned's dagger from its sheath and shoved it up to his chin.
His own dagger.
His smile was apologetic. I did warn you not to trust me, you know.
I hate this. It's kind of like, it took me so long to finish this chapter because I didn't want to get to this bit.
Mm-hmm. And it would totally make sense if Littlefinger doesn't really expect anything from Catelyn at this point to, like, just, mm-hmm. you know, I'm just doing this for my own revenge and that's enough. But, like, I don't know how much in the book, I can't remember, but at least in the show, like, trying to insinuate that, you know, maybe he can try and get with Catelyn after this, and it's like, are you serious? Like, you really think that's gonna happen? No.
Yeah, it's just deluded. I don't think in the books he has that expectation.
No, I don't think so either. I think he's just doing this just as sort of, like, revenge.
And favor with the queen.
A favor with the queen, yeah, to serve the Lannisters in the moment before he goes trotting off and sees that the Tyrells are way smarter or and way more easier to deal with mm-hmm. and are far more predictable, unlike crazy ass Joffrey.
Yeah, absolutely.
But thus concludes Ned's very painful betrayal.
It just gets worse.
Yep. And then we've got Arya.
And she's having her lessons with Sirio. And he's explaining to her, he's like telling Arya to practice mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Because he's telling her, you know, that he was going left and then he went right and then struck her. Is that what it is?
Yes. And, you know, you'll get to it in the Game of Thrones and philosophy book. There's a whole chapter about Arya and Zen.
Oh, right. Yeah. You know, he says, my words lied, my eyes and arms shouted the truth, but you were no longer seeing. And then he's explaining to her how he became the first sword of the Sea Lord of Braavos.
And which I love the discrepancies, like, he makes a distinction between watching and seeing, which is, which again, two totally different verbs. Like, I know at least in French, like, there is different verbs, like, regarder is to, like, watch, to regard something, and then ver is to see. And I'm assuming mm-hmm. it's the same in Portuguese and Spanish as well.
I don't know. Hang on, let me think.
Sorry, I didn't mean to, like, you know, try and wake up the sleeping Portuguese.
yeah, my head wasn't in there. I need to be quicker on switching them, since I'm going to Brazil this summer. And my boyfriend doesn't speak any Portuguese, so I'll be having to, you know, when I'm talking to my family, I'm gonna have to be translating things for him. Yeah. So I need to be quicker to switch. But yeah, you do have olhar and you have ver, mm-hmm. but they are sort of the same thing when yeah. I think about it, when you use them. But yeah.
And it's like, and now you are dead. You are dead now. It makes you think, did you ever see Zootopia?
Yes.
Well, yeah. The polar bear drill sergeant's like, guess what? Dead. You're dead, Fluffy Bunny.
Yeah. You know what? That would be serial. But so he's explaining the fact that the first sword was nearly dead, and the Sea Lord was sent, you know, asked him to come and see him, and he had like a cat, a fat yellow cat on his lap. And he was meant to be, you know, a beast.
Like a half measle, like Crookshanks, like in Harry Potter, like something but extra way, special.
Yeah, but way bigger, and, you know. And the Sea Lord asked him, have you ever seen her? Have you seen anything like her? And he says, I see every day. And it's because, you know, he just saw it's a cat, just a normal cat. Other people were, you know, didn't really notice that it was a cat. It was just because he was fat, because he ate a lot. And mm-hmm. its ears were short because, or cut off because, you know, there was like kitten fights and he lost his mm-hmm. ear, but it was just a tomcat.
Yeah, I also kind of interpreted it as also more of a lesson of he was willing, like maybe people had a feeling mm-hmm. that it was a cat, but no one was willing to voice it to like in front of the Lord that your precious pet is just a normal like tomcat. But you know, Serial was the first one to do it. And, you know, there are lots of stories in literature like this of someone who is like of a lower like socioeconomic position and calls out the BS or like challenges the person in higher authority in some mm-hmm. fashion, and that the person in higher authority is so, you know, impressed by that mm-hmm. they, whether it's beginning a mentor relationship or, you know, is willing to help them, you know, and becomes the catalyst for the underdog's upward social mobility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so this comes up a lot in literature, and I think it's, you know, even happens in Mad Men, the way Don Draper gets hired originally at the Sterling Cooper agency. But quite honestly, at least in terms of the supervisors I've had, like, at least the men I've worked under, they're far too egotistical for them to be impressed by someone calling something out like this.
Yeah.
Or at least I, as a woman, like a lot of, you know, probably examples I'm thinking of are men challenging other men, which, you know, men challenging, that's okay. But for a woman to challenge something, that's not a thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Or it's not as socially acceptable. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, because you're lower than them, apparently. But, you know, then, you know, he's telling her, you know, the heart lies in the head, plays tricks on us, but the eyes see true. So mm-hmm. make sure you are paying attention to what you're seeing, to what you are hearing. So he's basically telling her, practice mindfulness, be in the moment, mm-hmm. and, you know, assess the situation as clearly as possible without trusting what you think it might be.
Yeah, don't let the past taint what you're truly seeing, and don't let the worry of the future, you know, taint it either. Mm-hmm. Just always be in the moment.
Yeah, and this is what broke my heart, because they're making plans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he says, I'm thinking that when we're reaching this Winterfell of yours, it'll be time to put this needle in your hand. And she's mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, I can't wait to show John. I guess, like, she was going to say, I can't wait to show him, like, how well I've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then the City Watch comes in and Lannister guards.
Yeah, and I was very disappointed that the whole there's no God and there's only one God and his name is Death. I'm disappointed that that wasn't in the book, that that's just a show invention, because it's become so iconic.
Yeah, it is very iconic.
And there is a meme about with Cyril Farrell, and it says, "And what do we say to like socialism? Not today." So that that shows up, and then the actual actor is like, "Screw this! Like, screw conservatives using my character for yeah. you know this crap because I'm all for like you know maybe not hardcore socialism, but you know just having a general safety net for society."
Yeah, yeah. So you know, Arya recognizes Sir Meryn Trant because his visor's up.
Yep, his visor's up, and
and then you know they come in and say, you know, you need to come with us, and she's like, "Why? Is it your father called us?" And she was going to go, and Cyril's like, "Uh-uh, why is he sending Lannister people to come and fetch her daughter?"
Yeah, and which
to his daughter.
Honestly, you know, you could interpret it as, you know, just Cyril Farrell is a very observant person and can tell something's amiss. But honestly, I don't
think... But again, it comes back to this thing, you know, judge your eyes, judge your ears. And yeah, what is perceived. It's a classic case of, you know, George R. R. Martin wrote that. And then immediately after, he's showing it in practice. And the fact that Arya just, you know, hasn't done that.
Yeah, well, and again, we could say that Cyril is very observant, which he is, but I don't think Ned makes it very secret that of his disdain for the Lannisters. Yeah, no. And so I don't think Cyril is making a huge stretch right now and being like, what the hell?
Exactly. But the thing is, as well, Arya should have realized that. I mean, I don't know if she should. She's only eight.
She's 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
But yeah, that is something to think about. Like, you know, we train children to be like, you know, want them to be well-behaved, obedient, and things like that. But if you train them to just be obedient and, you know, they can get taken advantage of by dangerous adults. And so, like, we're so obsessed with, you know, just, you know, our children being accepted in polite society that we don't think, oh, you don't know shit about this random guy in the park who's trying to tempt you with the puppy. You don't listen to what he says.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, Cyril's just like, what the hell? Like, you know, and they and the Lannister guards have no chill. They have no patience. And it's like, so was the king... Like, I am a sworn brother of the Kingsguard, the White Swords. So was the Kingslayer when he killed the old king. I don't have to go with you if I don't want. So, and that's... I thought Cyril said that. No, Arya says that. So...
Yeah.
Even she can understand that, you know, being a sworn brother of the Kingsguard doesn't mean shit.
Yeah, means absolute shit. So, yeah, so they move to take her, and then Cyril kind of steps in between them and tells her, you know, you need to leave because it's gonna get ugly. But she hangs around a little bit just so we can see a bit of the fighting, because she says that Cyril has like been taking it easy when on they her. Were on her, because she truly saw how he was fighting. And that reminds me of when Harry truly sees Voldemort. Yes.
What I originally thought of is, you know, when everyone sees, you know, Yoda fight for the first time as a Jedi Master with his little lightsaber.
Yeah, his little lightsaber. So she was saying, you know, he took down basically all of them. Five men were down, dead or dying by the time Arya reached the back door that opened to the kitchen.
Yes.
And then he went head to head with Meryn Trant.
Trant. Pronounced it Meryn Trant, yeah. And the fact that Cyril could do this all by, you know, without his own like steel sword, he's just like whacking the shit out of them with a wooden sword.
Yeah, and then one of them was a dagger that he took from one of the guards.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts? Like, it's never really discussed. We don't know if Cyril dies or not. So do you think he's alive?
It would be nice for him to be alive, but...
Everyone at least in season 8 were like, or season 7, 8, they were like desperate. Please, if you want to do like some like crazy ass fan fiction, can you just please bring Cyril back?
That would have been nice. That would have been really nice. But to be honest, I don't see why Meryn Trant is any more special than the other ones. Like, he beat five people. Why couldn't he have beaten Meryn?
Yeah, it's honestly, you know, there's a lot of fan theories about maybe like Sirio is the same as Jack and Hagar with the masks, which I'm not sure if I'm totally hell-bent on, you know, I'm sold on that. But, you know, just the nature of, you know, Sirio's like swiftness and like, you know, ninja-like qualities, I don't doubt that he could have at least, at the very least, knocked out Trant and been able to like surreptitiously like escape from the castle. Like, I don't think, you know, I think he has the same type of like stealth as a faceless man, if he isn't, even if he isn't one himself, to be able to get out of this situation.
Yeah, the faceless men, I guess they don't fight as much as more they disguise and, you know, move around in the shadows. But yeah, I think he would have absolutely been capable of killing Meryn Trant and just leaving. But yeah, as it suggests, he basically dies, which is ridiculous, but okay.
Which, does it say he dies? No.
No, but that's what he implies, I guess, because
At least Arya is
you
presuming
know,
that.
yeah, it's saying here, because he was hang on, Sirio danced away from his cut, that's Sir Meryn. His stick a blur. In a heartbeat, he had bounced blows off the knight's temple, elbow, and throat, and wood ringing against metal and helm, gauntlet, and gorget.
So basically, he's beating on Trant as if I'm beating on this Tibetan singing bowl.
Yeah, that sounds nice.
Although, just imagine if your helmet and you get, and that's all you hear, and it's in your
Yeah,
ears.
I think it's more like bong, you know, more deep. But you know, Sir Meryn advanced, Sirio backed away, he checked the next blow, spun away from the second, deflected the third. The fourth sliced his stick in two, splintering the wood and shearing through the lead core.
Which,
So
honestly,
it's saying
yeah.
here that basically, you know, he doesn't have a weapon anymore, which is stupid because there's five people just laying dead there, and he could have picked it up.
He could have picked one up, and also, I have every faith in Sirio to just pull out some Jackie Chan moves.
Yeah, but you know, so I guess it is from that, like cutting the like his weapon. He didn't have anything else, and I guess with Arya fleeing and sobbing, that is what
Yeah, but
it is
again, unless
implied.
there's a bo these sort of books, unless there's a body, I don't believe that they're dead.
That's true.
So, and you know, it's just interesting to think, you know, again, all these very, again, Eastern sort of mantras of comparing to animals, swift as a deer, quiet as a shadow, calm as still water, you know, and then, you know, there is
That's
this
all
sort
what
of,
Arya is thinking when she's trying to escape and
yeah,
leaving,
and
and
leaving and.
she gets sort of to a crossroad where she can go up to the Tower of the Hand or she can go out.
Down, down.
Yeah, and she says never do what they expect, which Sirius says to her. So she
And
goes
so
the opposite way.
she goes the opposite direction, and again, she's got a lot of bigger balls than me because the time where she has to like just walk across the courtyard as if nothing is wrong, like yeah, and rather than like be running around like screaming. It made me think of, there was a story, I forget, it was a World War II, like, you know, concentration camp like story where or not, maybe not directly with Jews or prisoners of war. Anyway, there was an incident, you know, imprisoned by the Nazis, and this guy was trying to like smuggle extra food, and so, but he had this, you know, huge pot of stew. And, you know, he was trying to smuggle it in, but he had to cross the courtyard, and the spotlight finally came on him. And instead of like running and screaming and, you know, alerting the tower, he just kept walking as if he had a purpose. And so to pretend like I'm supposed to be doing this, and literally they shined the light away from him, and he did not get in trouble. Or at least not at that moment, not at least not that night in that moment. I don't know if anyone followed up or anything, but yeah, had to do the same thing of just walk and pretend like I know exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's about having confidence, pretending to, anyway, and people don't suspect you.
Yeah,
But
like that's how so many con artists like get, like sneak into like exclusive cult clubs and like. Because if you just have the confidence and pretend that you're supposed to be there, very few people are actually going to question it.
yeah, for sure. And So Arya starts noticing some people that are wearing a cloak with grey wool and trimmed with white satin, and she was like, shit, it's people from my household.
Yeah, and they're all dead.
Yeah, and then she starts doubting her own, like, capabilities, and I think, you know, she is acting completely the opposite, but she says here, you know, anyhow, she was only a little girl with a wooden stick, alone and afraid. And, you know, the quick thinking that she has made, you know, immediately go, I can't go up to the tower, I need to go somewhere else, and just, like, you know, the walking across the courtyard. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, she's proving herself to not just be a little girl. She mm-hmm. really knows what she's doing when she actually likes something, because in the beginning you kind of think that she's a bit, like, stupid or whatever, because she doesn't know how to, mm-hmm. you know, sew like her sister.
And there is definitely kind of an insinuation that, you know, all of these sort of Zen characteristics, that these mantras that she's telling herself, you know, if not for Sirio's dancing lessons up to this point, she would not have been able to escape.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So she gets to the
stables.
Yeah.
And this boy is just like...
Well, first of all, she sees a bunch of people dead, and she sees that one of the trunks is open.
Like, yeah, it's turned over, and it's hers. Like, yeah, it's all the people who were, like, trying to prep to get everything to go to the ship.
Yeah, but then they got attacked, so everyone's dead. And then she's feeling around to try and find Nido, and while she's doing that, some little boy comes in, and he's like, "Oh, there she is."
Which, like, I'm just curious how quickly word can, like, you know, spread in terms of, like, it's one thing for the guards to, like, be on the lookout and stuff, but the fact that that this little boy thinks he's going to get any sort of, like, substantial reward, like, and just have any might. Well, I don't know. Father's dead, the voice said. It's the queen who'll be rewarding me. Come here, girl. Stay away. I said come. And yeah.
So basically they're struggling, and he grabs her, and then she just she says everything that Sirio has told her went out the window, and the only thing that came to her head was what John said to her, stick him with the pointy end. And she fully just, like, stick him in the belly, and it came out between his shoulder blades, and he's like, oh, just take it out. When she did, he died, and he was bleeding out, and that's her first kill, which is very significant. You know, at 8 years old, doing that, it's balls. Yeah. She has the balls.
Yes, she does have a lot of balls. And the horses are screaming, and she's like, wants to get a horse, but she's like, shit, all the gates are closed. I can't get out on horse.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, she goes to where she tries. Well, she doesn't try. She does go and gets to the where all the skulls, the dragons.
Well, yeah, because she's like, there is one way out that no one would think of, but that requires going, you know, down to all the dragon skulls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she's reliving because it's like it's really dark. She steals some candles from the sept. When she gets there, she's a bit scared, but then she realizes that, you know, in Winterfell the crypt in Winterfell is way scarier than that,
and way darker and probably more intricate in its passageways.
And then she's remembering the fact that, you know, they were young and Bran was only a baby, and Rob took them down to the crypt to show them their own graves, which is creepy,
or telling ghost stories, and then John shows up in a bunch of flour.
Precious. I know, and she, you know, Sansa and Bran runs away, but she laughs.
She laughs, and it's like, you're scaring the baby.
yeah, she hits him and says, you're scaring the baby, and then after that, she was like, I wasn't scared anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yes, that's so sad.
Yeah, so she...
I'm all about the John Arya sibling relationship, it's so sweet.
I know.
I'm glad J.R.R. Martin did not go the incestuous route like he might have been intending.
Yes, that would be really nice to not have a fucked up sibling relationship.
Although technically, if John is with his quote unquote true heritage, that's just cousins, and they have no qualms marrying cousins in this universe.
I mean, yeah, clearly not aunties in and nephews either.
Yeah, there was a funny funny like behind the scenes like featurette of, you know, that scene, and Kit Harington was just being like, you know, I just go like, ooh, like about to retch. He's like, oh, let's go again. The memory made Arya smile, and after that, the darkness held no more terrors. The stable boy was dead, she killed him, and if he jumped out at her, she'd kill him again. She was going home. Everything would be better once she was home again, safe behind Winterfell's gray granite walls. Her footsteps sent soft echoes hurrying ahead of her as Arya plunged deeper into the darkness.
Oh, poor Arya.
Honestly, like, yeah, just footsteps in the darkness makes me think of when, like, Link in Legend of Zelda is about to enter one of the, like, temples.
Mm. I haven't seen many Legend of Zelda. Legend of Zelda, yeah. It's so ridiculous because behind me, as you can see, it's a bunch of
video games.
And my boyfriend's favorite one is Legend of Zelda. And I'm here like, I don't know them much. I only know, what's the name with the one with the... It's like a little... It's not Ocarina of Time.
The Ocarina of Time? Oh, like...
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah, it's Ocarina of Time then. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's like the... That was revolutionary for its time. Anyway, mm-hmm. Thus concludes, you know, Arya's chapter.
Yes.
Just a lot going on now.
Yeah, yeah. Now it's going to really ramp up.
Indeed. Shall we get into our history lessons?
Let's do it.
What was yours?
So, keeping in theme with betrayals.
Ooh.
I thought we could have a look, have a gander, at the biggest betrayals in history.
There's Brutus and Caesar.
That's one.
And yes. Two Brute.
Yeah. So I got this from allthat'sinteresting.com. And I know, right?
Aptly named.
I know. So we have, the first one, we have Alfred Redl in Austria. So before and during World War One, Redl worked as a... Let's start again. So before and during World War One, Redl worked as a spy for Russian military and sold secrets about the Austrian army. Redl leaked the Australian, not the Australian, blah. Redl leaked the Austrian invasion plan for Serbia, which Russia in turn sold to Serbia. He continued to double-cross his countrymen by supplying the wrong information about Russia's military strength and exposing Austrian agents to the enemy. The results were catastrophic for the Austrian army. His actions contributed to the death of 500,000 Austrians. Redl committed suicide after Austrian police discovered his betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is a guy who is considered one of the worst traitors of the Second World War. And his name was Harold Paul Cole. And he was the deputy commander of Scotland Yard during the end of World War II. And for those who don't know what Scotland Yard is, it's basically the
Secret police. Service.
It's the police. It's not the Secret Service. Secret Service will be MI5 and MI6. Mm-hmm. So Scotland Yard is basically the police in mm-hmm. London. That's mm-hmm. what they call him. He was responsible for divulging information to the Gestapo about the French resistance escape lines, which he had helped create. He also divulged information about the French resistance leaders to the Axis, resulting in the death of at least 150 people. And he was shot dead after capture by French police in 1946. So, you know.
Like, is this traitor for money or just idealistic things?
Idealistic things. Yeah, not money. Yeah. So then we have Brutus and Caesar, as you said. For those who don't know, the tyrannical rule of Roman Emperor Julius Caesar came to a very sticky end when his own nephew, Marcus Junius Brutus, took part in the murder plot against him. Brutus joined the Roman Senate during a time when the revolt against Caesar was reaching its peak. Despite demonstrations from his wife, Brutus accompanied a group of disgruntled senators who savagely attacked Caesar. And then obviously Caesar had no idea. And that's when he comes to, you know, when he's like dying, he goes to Brutus and says, "They're to Brutus," which means then, "What about you?"
Yeah, and you too. And I will admit, I really like Shakespeare's rendition of Julius Caesar.
Mm-hmm. And now we have the Roseburgs in USA. So the Roseburgs were a married couple with communist sympathies who sold atomic secrets to the Soviets during the height of the Cold War. Julius Rosenberg helped exchange covert information and also recruited other spies for the Soviet Union. He, alongside his wife Ethel, whose level of involvement, if any at all, is still contentious, was arrested in 1950. After a controversial trial, both were executed for conspiring to sell atomic secrets to Russia on the 19th of June, 1953.
Interesting.
The next one is someone called Mir Jafar, and he was the head of army. He was the head of the army of Bengal during the mid 18th century, but his ambitions were a bit higher because for the better part of his lifetime, Jafar had conspired to usurp the throne of Bengal. In his quest, he joined hands with British forces during the decisive Battle of Plassey. The battle was fought between East India Company forces led by Robert Clive and the Indian force led by Nawab Sira-ud-Dowla of Oud, and was the culmination of tension and suspicions between the two sides. Although the Indian force greatly outnumbered the British, Mir Jafar's actions ensured British victory. He and his large troop sat idly by as the battle waged, and without his help, the British force was able to defeat the Nawab's men and gain full control of the Indian subcontinent.
Nice.
And the last one is Aldrich Ames. Spurred by an alcohol addiction and a wife of expensive taste, Aldrich Ames readily sold U.S. government secrets to Russia during the 1980s. Ames worked at the CIA, and it got him access to military intelligence and the names of every U.S. agent in operation against Russia. Mm-hmm. Intelligence he willingly surrendered. His efforts earned him $4.6 million and resulted in the compromised position of 100 military operations and the execution of 10 U.S. operatives. Ames was eventually sentenced to life in prison.
Yeah. Oh, no, I just, you know, reading all those, I was thinking of one. So I think we discussed earlier, because, you know, my husband is, you know, Iranian-American, like, activist and, like, political commentator. He, you know, there was this instance, you know, either last year or 2020, where the FBI had to shuttle this one female Iranian, like, journalist and activist around because it came out that the Iranian regime was planning to, like, shove her on a boat from New York, take her to Venezuela, and then from Venezuela fly her to Iran to do whatever, you know, they were going to do to her. And the one person I'm thinking about is, can't exactly find her name, but basically to help facilitate this sort of plot, there was, like, an Iranian-American woman in California who was kind of being the middleman to, like, disguise all the money for this operation, you know, being handled. And so hopefully she's being charged with, at the very least, embezzlement or whatever crap if they can't directly nab her with, like, traitor charges or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, fuck that lady.
Well, 100%.
Yeah. So
what is yours?
Yeah, mine is, you know, I was kind of thinking, you know, kind of traitors, but then I ended up going into escapes.
Oh,
in the way Arya has to escape from King's Landing. So I went
with The Great Escape.
The Great Escape of Queen Mary of Scots.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, it wasn't actually the first time that she tried to escape. So when she was in Lochleven Castle, like, her first attempt to escape, she was disguised as a washerwoman. And this was thwarted when a boatman spotted her white hands beneath the rags. And however, as escapes go, her second one was rather more successful. So
why is she trying to escape, first of all?
She's trying to escape because, you know, just the whole issue.
And where is she trying to escape from?
Well, she's, again, the whole thing about Queen Mary of Scots and Queen Elizabeth, and basically, again, British history, I'm not quite as familiar with the dynamics of Mary Queen of Scots, that basically Mary Queen of Scots was trying to, like, she wasn't doing exactly, I think, as Queen Elizabeth, you know, wanted, and I think there was some tension, there was some politics of Catholic and Protestant stuff involved, and, you know, lots of things. So it got to a point where Queen Elizabeth basically wanted Queen Mary of Scots in prison, you know, imprisoned. So she was. And so the second time she tried to escape, how did it go? The second attempt, which took place on May 2nd, 1568, which involved drugging half the island with a hearty dose of wine whilst young Willie Douglas pegged all the boats to the shore bar one, was markedly more successful. Once more in disguise, Mary walked out of the gates of the castle in full view in the midst of the May Day festivities that the young boy had arranged, with himself cast as abbot of the unreasonable. So dancing around the table in the great hall, he flung his handkerchief over the keys to the castle grounds, and as Sir William Douglas dozed drinkingly beside them. So yeah, kind of this festival of fools that Mary Queen of Scots was able to, like, just walk away in plain sight, and similar to what Arya does, and because she's not, obviously not, she's disguised, she's not garbed in anything,
yeah,
you know, people don't think that, oh, that's our captive, like, in the same way that no one recognized Catelyn because she's not in fancy clothes.
Yeah.
And it just kind of shows, like, the pageantry of the nobility, that no one sees the actual face. They just see all the, like, bells, the sparkles and glitter and shit.
Yeah. It's that thing that Syria Fora said. It's about looking but not seeing.
Yeah. So she was able to escape that way, and originally she wanted, like, there was a choice, like, she could have, like, once they got on the boat and got out of there was this, like, decision, like, they could have gone to France, which is where Mary Queen of Scots grew up most of her life, or go to England. And so she originally was set for England, but then she, like, claims to have this dream, and she's like, no, I don't want to go to England, I want to go to France. But it was too late, and then she got, I don't know if whether by sea itself or on land, but she got apprehended and, you know, got captured again until, like, you know, her death.
Yeah, she was captured in and kept in the Tower of London.
I'm not sure if it was the Tower of London. I know Queen Anne was stuck in the Tower of London.
Yeah, no, it was. There's this guy on TikTok who he lives in the Tower of London because his dad is part of,
like,
the
steward or whatever.
Yeah, and he was like, because he had COVID, he was, like, trapped inside, and he was just like, he had to be, and then he was outside in this, like, bit of the Tower of London, and he was like, this is where Mary Queen of Scots would, you know, come and have a stroll, that they would let her have a stroll when she was imprisoned here.
Yeah, oh, that's terrible. Of all the places to spend your COVID quarantine, in the Tower of London.
I know. That's scary.
Okay. Alrighty then, and now we can move on to friendship lessons.
So mine was based on Ned, again, a don't do, is don't be so easy to trust others. and I think, like, those, especially those that you consider new friends, you don't know them. I am very guilty of doing that. It's kind of like word vomit when I meet someone and they showed me a bit of kindness. I'm just like, well, so here's my life, you know, so... Mm-hmm. It's sort of like be aware who you trust. I guess.
And it's be aware of who you trust, because, you know, just because people, it's like you want to think, oh, like, they're listening to me, like, they're my confidant, they confide in me, but it's like, is this because they genuinely care, or are they intelligence gathering?
Exactly. Yeah.
Because knowledge is power.
Yeah.
my friendship lesson, of course, comes from Sam. Which, you know, there is something to be said of, you know, of validating your, you know, friends' feelings in the moment, but also, you know, don't like help your friends to see beyond very short-sighted goals. Like, help them to keep in mind, like, the bigger picture at hand. That if some, and if there are certain ways to, you know, reinterpret a situation, and it doesn't make the person's original, like, negative interpretation necessarily wrong, but it's like, that's not the only option. You're not operating with all of the information. Just because Alistair Thorne looks very smug doesn't mean that it's an automatic correlation, causation, whatever.
No, that's good. I like that. Sam was a very good friend.
Very good friend. And again, which I'm so disappointed that John, like, is like, oh, I'm supposed to be like a girl being a steward. And it's like, bitch, who do we have?
So we have Sansa, John, and Bran.
Oh,
we finally got a break from Ned. I guess there's not much going on in the dungeons.
No, not much going on in the dungeons. The Sansa chapter will be interesting if I recall which one it is. But yeah, Sansa, Bran, and John?
Sansa, John, and Bran.
All right, then. So stay tuned, everyone. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Podcaster's Landing. The music to our intro is copyrighted by Persian-German composer Ramin Djawadi. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophia Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMare Studios. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.